Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with my guests this hour, Erica C. Barnett, who writes for the CisForCrank.com. Hey, Erica.
Hey, Bill.
Jossie Ross is a local attorney and writer and activist. Good to see you again, Jossie.
Always good to see you, Bill.
Pamela Banks, president of the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
This week, well, Washington got an unusual visitor, a Republican presidential candidate. What are you doing in Everett, Donald Trump? Did you get lost?
You know, on television, they said, I wonder why he's going to the state of Washington, because you know what? Republicans don't win it, but we're going to win it. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. And this love affair began about 3 months ago when I came up here, and we've had record crowds, two events, massive, massive crowds. And I said, why don't the Republicans win that state? I think we're going to win Washington State. So that's the story. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm here.
That's Donald Trump having a love affair, as he said, at the Xfinity Arena in Everett on Tuesday. Then, the following day, Trump visited another unexpected place, Mexico, where he was relatively polite to Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto.
I have many friends, so many friends, and so many friends coming to Mexico and in Mexico. I'm proud to say how many people I employ. And the United States, first, second, and third generation Mexicans are just beyond reproach. Spectacular, spectacular, hardworking people.
Then, after being nice to Mexico's president, Trump headed to Arizona to say this.
Most illegal immigrants are lower skilled workers with less education who compete directly against vulnerable American workers, and that these illegal workers draw much more out from the system than they can ever possibly pay back. And they're hurting a lot of our people that cannot get jobs under any circumstances.
And Trump reiterated his call to deport millions of people. So there's a lot to say here. Pamela, you said that even if Trump loses, you have found in your experience that you think he's contributed to a new kind of openness of racial hostility that might remain after the election. Is that fair?
That's very fair.
What have you seen?
I have seen an increased number of incidences that are racially insensitive. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Recently, one of our contractors who's African-American and lives on the east side, he's lived over there 30 plus years. And he said he was driving down the street and he saw a big pickup truck, and it had a big American flag flying on one side and a big Confederate flag flying on the other. And the guy had a Trump sticker on his bumper. And I had a recent incident in April. I drive up and down the I-5 corridor a lot because my family lives in Portland. And I actually had stopped at a rest area, which I normally don't do. And this Caucasian man, he hit my car with his hand. I was bent down. I was getting ready to get out of my car. And I looked up and he flipped me off and started calling me all these racial slurs just out of nowhere. And I opened the door and I said, excuse me, like, do you have an issue? Like, what did I do? And he was like, you almost hit me. And he just cursed me out like every racial epithet. And that floored me. That really took me aback. And then there's been incidences on Capitol Hill and just young people in our summer program, getting called out of their names. And so I just see this. It's been an increase in that just in this last, last few months. But I think since he started running.
And how do you decide whether it's appropriate to link those anecdotes to a Trump candidacy?
I think having a black president for the last 8 years also brought it out. And I think because it made people feel like, when you have elected officials that can put their finger in our president's face and disrespect our president and call him a liar and it's accepted, I attribute it to all of that, too. And I think he has made it with his racial rhetoric and his comments. He has made a lot of white people feel very comfortable in coming out with their true feelings. And that's why I call it the Trump effect.
Trump effect. Jossie, anything along those lines? Your experience, or is that not your experience?
No, I mean, I definitely is emboldened. But I think it's emboldened the racism that was already there. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever gone anyplace, and it's just been an exposing, a peeling back of that political nicety that has been, you know, and some people would say that that's in fact the cancer and not the racism itself, the fact that people were able to disguise it for so long.
Could that be necessary work, the outing of the racism you say has already always been there?
I think Donald Trump, in a really, really weird way, for a person with caveman mentality, might be contributing to the evolution of the United States, that you actually have somebody who's who's bringing forth these feelings. Because for so long, there's been, I think they call it gaslighting. You heard that term?
Yeah, you sort of pretend that the issue isn't the issue.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. And so for so long, for people of color, there's been this thing where we say something is, it's racist. I know that something is there. I know that something is there. But then we're made to feel crazy because, well, no, it's really not there. But Donald Trump, fortunately, has taken that gaslight away. And in fact, yeah, all of those feelings, you were right all along. There really is this strong animosity against Muslims, against Mexicans. Walter Scott really did get shot in broad daylight. Donald Sterling really did say all of these things, and it was brought to light. And so it's exposed for all white folks to say, wow, it really is there. And hopefully that will be the effect that white people realize that, no, we weren't crazy all this time.
What do you think, white person, Erica?
Well, I part white, but as yeah, I mean, I think that the outing of this attitude is as Jossie said, it's a good thing in a certain sense, but I also think that we have to remember that you know, in all likelihood, Donald Trump is going to lose, and hopefully lose pretty badly, and I think that, you know, says something, that's, you know, something about both the fact that this is a minority of people, and hopefully a, you know, the sort of virulent white, you know, racist, misogynistic, xenophobic, you know, people that are coming out in support of Donald Trump is a small minority of America. And I think that the media has a real responsibility that it has been shirking terribly to point out that there is both, you know, both that this is not the majority of people, and that this is something that, you know, that does need to be pointed out over and over and over again. But also, I think they've been shirking their responsibility to say Donald Trump is an outlier. He is not a normal presidential candidate. And I think they've been constantly creating this false equivalence between him and Hillary Clinton that normalizes him and in some ways normalizes this kind of rhetoric. And, you know, a lot of people sent me that New York Times video a while back of all the Donald Trump people saying racist things. And they were like, can you believe this? Can you believe this? And I mean, yeah, what I couldn't believe is that it was shocking and that the media and the New York Times had to say, hey, this is this new thing that we're exposing and there's going to be some rough language in here. So, you know, warning. They should be doing that every single day, and they should be exposing that every single day, and they're not. And I think that is a real tragedy this election. I think they've really fallen down on their responsibilities.
Okay, we're going to move on from Trump talk. I before we leave the topic, though, because we've brought up this question of racism and how what will happen to it. This week, I had a conversation with a local organizer for a group called CARW, which stands for Coalition for Anti-Racist Whites. Her name is Becca Meredith. And she was talking about how if you are white and you want to challenge even the accidental racism of people around you, here's how to do it. She was saying, you don't have to antagonize. You don't have to be that uncomfortable. Ask some questions.
If someone says, it's so cool that Obama got elected, we're in a really post-racial society. It's beautiful.
What would I say to that?
Yeah, I mean, you can start with different, there's sort of different approaches. One could be questions. So that's really interesting. Where did you hear that? Oh, I heard it on blah, 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 this or that. Oh, okay. You know, sort of inquiring in and trying to figure out where did it come from? And maybe saying like, does it feel true to you? You know, because sometimes people are just regurgitating what they're hearing. So it's sort of connecting that person to their actual experience and maybe some other stories that are happening, like black people getting killed every week, you know, every 28 hours in this country. Does that feel like we're in a post-racial society? You know, just kind of surfacing
questions.
Some
That's
facts.
Good. Questions are non-threatening.
They are. You know, they're a great way, especially for someone who you may feel might be defensive anyways, but I think it's just a good approach.
President of the Urban League, Pamela Banks, any advice for non-racist white people?
I totally agree. I mean, all the work that we did around undoing institutionalized racism, the Race and Social Justice Initiative that I was a part of when I worked in the city of Seattle, that's exactly how you have to do it. Because I think having white people acknowledge their privilege and working with organizations like that, because they used to call themselves, you know, the anti-racist whites. They had a coalition. And when we would break out into affinity groups to do this kind of work. And so I think it is an education piece about it. And I think that President Obama's election has made people think that we're in this post-racial society, but they don't look at the underlying things, the income inequality gap and the home ownership, you know, for blacks and whites, and really educating people and start talking about the historical things and the institutions that are set up to keep that gap going. And so I think when you are addressing folks that make comments like that, it is non-threatening. And so, you know, she lays out a good series of questions to say when people say things like that, because I think it makes them more comfortable, and especially in the Northwest. I mean, I know Jossie can attest to this. Just, you know, we travel a lot. I travel a lot. You know, in the South, you know, racism is in your face. Like, people will let you know. I mean, look how long it took to get the Confederate flag down out of South Carolina. I mean, that just happened, right? And here, it's very subtle. So people don't want to think, because we're so progressive and we're so liberal, that it doesn't happen here. And it happens here every day. And again, you can go look at our data around graduation rates for African Americans, incarceration rates for African Americans and, you know, black and brown people. So it mirrors across the country. It's just, we're so polite here.
Jossie, would you agree that in the Northwest you would better be careful about calling a liberal white person racist or privileged?
It depends on what your agenda is. I have no problem with it, but I'm self-employed. I think that, you know, there's absolutely this evolutionary thing where we feel like this is the crux of, you know, all civilization up here to, you know, wear Birkenstocks and possibly go to Evergreen State College and you know, feel like you have camaraderie-ship. But, and that's a real thing. I think that there's a aspirational side to Seattle and the Pacific Northwest that is absolutely genuine, where people want to feel, white folks want to feel like they are in fact part, they got the secret handshake. And that's cool. But here's the thing, is that the face of secret handshakes keeps on changing. Racism, structural racism, keeps on evolving. You know, you went from just outright Jim Crow laws to restrictive covenants to redlining to more pernicious and ugly insidious things. And so we have to be careful to always recognize that, as Pamela said, that we don't think just because we arrive at a certain echelon of achievement, whether it be President Barack Obama or you know, a black governor or whatever it is, that particular thing, that we think that we've arrived. No, folks will always find a way to change that face of racism and structural racism.
Well, I think, you know, this reminds me of the work that I do as a feminist writer and as someone who, you know, has a day job doing feminist work and women's advocacy work. My attitude is a little different than Pam's. I have the attitude that it's not my responsibility to educate you and to ease you into the idea that women are people. And I think the same thing, I mean, I am not in a, I don't have standing to say how white people should be taught about racism and about structural racism. So I can only go to a similar example, which is the fact that women are people and should be treated equally. I live on the internet. I deal with people on the internet all day long. And if they come at me with sort of concern trolling questions about, well, you know, is this really rape? Or why do you think that women are paid 79 cents on the dollar? Is that really true? Let me show you all this data. I just block them, because honestly, there's a disingenuous version of that that is pernicious and really common, where people present themselves one way as, say, an ally of women or an ally of black people or an ally of people of color. And I think you can waste a lot of time having that conversation, and it doesn't necessarily produce any results.
So instead of just asking those sensitive, thoughtful questions, let's explore that. Let's get past that.
I don't
and
have
just
the
confront.
Time. Yeah. I don't have the time in my life for sensitive, thoughtful questions all day.
If I could just interject on that. I agree. It's not anybody's responsibility. Being Native American, there's so few of us that if somebody doesn't answer those questions, then nobody's ever going to have a right response to those questions. And so I find myself, and I think a lot of Native people similarly feel, that it is our job to be educators all the time. And that gets exhausting.
It does.
But once again, if that's not there, there's no book on right answers that, you know, and how not to ask stupid questions about Native people, because there's a lot of stupid questions. And so
what's stupid question number one?
Well, I tell you a quick story. Very recently, I was in a hotel lobby where I had about an hour long conversation. And then after that hour long conversation, the young lady said, can I ask you a question? And I knew something was stupid coming because she asked permission to ask a question. But then she said, how much do you get for your check? And I said, I don't know. I'm self-employed. Sometimes I get no check. She said, no, how much do you get for your Indian check? My friend told me that all Indians get checks from casinos. So stuff like that is endemic. And this was to my face. This is from the horse's mouth. And it's very common to get those sort of questions. And those are absolutely false, wrong. But somebody has to correct
it. At least she asked.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I had a chance to counter. She argued with me about the information that I gave her. But you still have an opportunity to hopefully educate.
She requested your bank statements.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wish I had it.
I want to talk about something else that happened this week and again last night, kind of on this subject in a way. The quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers, Colin Kaepernick, again declined to stand as the national anthem was played before his game. Kaepernick has said he's not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color.
There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust. People aren't being held accountable for. And that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for: freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
Now, as Colin Kaepernick was kneeling last night during the anthem, Seattle cornerback Jeremy Lane was the only Seahawk to sit during the national anthem while it was playing in Oakland. In other words, while their San Francisco colleague was getting booed and criticized, Russell Wilson and Richard Sherman and Pete Carroll and every other Seahawk stood during the national anthem, even though the NFL reiterated this week that players and coaches don't have to stand if they don't want to. Jossie, what kind of politics and patriotism, if any, do you want from your hometown football team?
I think it was a great Jedi mind trick to mix politics and athletics in the first place. That was the point of the Olympics, sort of to get away from politics. That was the notion. And it had an amazing effect, you know, whether you're talking about the Munich Games, you're talking about various times during the Cold War where there was a complete separation, or hopefully aspirationally a separation, of politics and athletics. Really, athletics is about entertainment. And theoretically, that is supposed to be something that's devoid of politics. So I'm the notion. It's cool, you know, that obviously First Amendment, right, you have a right to stand up or not stand up. But I think we have to inquire a little bit deeper about the baseline assumptions that, should we even be doing this in the first place? Like, should this be a part of this entertainment process? If this is something that
should we be playing the national anthem before a football
game? That's right. Yeah, it's like, it's sort of like, you know, one thing that Native people do is we separate very, very clearly our religious ceremonies and our social ceremonies. You won't hear the same songs. You won't have the same protocols. And here in the United States, patriotism is pretty much the religion. And so there's no separation of those things. And so obviously it's going to put a lot of people in an uncomfortable position when, as a matter of fact, the vast majority of people within this game, whether it be basketball or football, or football in the Pac-10 conference where these guys can't even get an athletic scholarship, or, you know, where they've taken away affirmative action, but yet they're expected to go out there and just be good soldiers, at some point somebody's going to call that into question, so long as we continue to conflate this theology or ideology of patriotism and the athletic contest.
And I agree with Jossie, Bill. I said, who thought of that before every game that you play the national anthem? What does that have to do with it's entertainment? And these guys are getting paid billions of dollars, millions of dollars that will eventually turn into billions at the rate they're going. And what Colin has done, and I support what he's done, and I really appreciate what Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said about him. And I think about what Muhammad Ali did, what he stood for, what the two Olympians that put their hands up in the 60s, the Black Power movement, you know, these guys were, you know, they're very patriotic, but then they come back to, or all the Vietnam vets that went over, black people went over in the Vietnam War, got killed and maimed and came back to the United States and couldn't get a job. Or, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, to me, it's hypocrisy. And so I don't understand. And this controversy that I find has surrounded it, it's really taking away the message which Colin is trying to convey. It's saying, look, there are black people getting shot and killed on a weekly basis by the police. There are, you know, segregated schools. We have segregated schools in Seattle. We have a segregated Seattle, if you want to really look at it, north of the Ship Canal, south of Ship Canal. People don't want to talk about that. They want to take away what his stance is meaning to him personally and make it about whether or not he's patriotic, whether or not he supports the troops. We all support the troops. Everybody going over there is giving us the right to be able to take that stand, to either stand or not stand. I think about how they vilified Gabby Douglas, who was raised in a military family, because she didn't put her hand over her heart. You don't have to do that. She stood at attention. We were taught to stand at attention. My father was in the military. So I think it just conflates. It's really trying to take the, you know, not address the true issues, the systemic issues that make people feel this way, and it's really sad to me.
Well, since you asked, I'm the last person who could speak for a sports league and why they do what they do, but I think the idea of the national anthem is you've brought together a huge group of strangers, which is its own potentially chaotic or tense situation, and then you've got two teams from two different cities and probably states, and it's this moment of, okay, what do we all have in common? We do this in lots of different contexts, right? What do we all have in common? And now let's have some fun and watch people beat the crap out of each other.
Well, I mean, as much as I find it kind of appalling that we look to sports people who are largely in their young 20s to guide us and to guide our children on how to behave and what to believe, the fact is that we do. And so I admire this person's stance. Can you tell I'm not a sports person myself? So like I said, I would not have known about this except that it did get national attention. But I do admire it. On the other hand, I also think that far be it for me to say what being a good NFL player is and a good patriot is, especially because I am not a black man. And if, you know, if Marshawn Lynch doesn't want to say anything, if Richard Sherman doesn't want to say anything, you know, far be it from me. I don't have standing to police that behavior, nor do I have standing to say you should kneel, you should sit, you should, you know, make a protest, you should make a point, or you shouldn't.
Oh, heck, we judge people all the time without being in their shoes.
I just wow. Imagine the pressure of being a public figure at that level and not being a political person and being criticized for taking a political stance that is protected under the Constitution. And I mean, I think there's nothing more patriotic, really, than exercising your First Amendment right. But at the same time, I don't think that it's, you know, I just don't think that we should be putting these young men on a pedestal in the way that we do and putting so much pressure on them to take political stances or to not take political stances or to behave in the way that we see fit.
Well, we got a comment from a listener who said, Marty said, I wish it would amount to something. And whether you would agree with this or not, it would have been interesting and more likely to amount to something, maybe, if the Seahawks, for example, because they all could, as I said, the NFL doesn't require you to stand. The Seahawks, the Seattle team, could have reacted very differently from how the Dallas Cowboys might have reacted. They could have all sat down, and Pete Carroll could have said, we have Democrats and Republicans and independents on this team, and we all love our country, and we all want it to be even better, and we all support our troops who fight for our constitutional right of free speech to not, you know, stand when the anthem is playing. That would have been interesting.
I'd rather see politicians saying Black Lives Matter and actually taking action on it. And maybe these kinds of things maybe that scenario that you described would push politicians in that direction. But ultimately, I would rather see actual political movement rather than symbolic movement. On the other hand, it's football and it's not something that I particularly care about one way or another. So maybe I don't even have standing to comment on that.
You know,
let's all not comment on anything that we don't have standing to talk about. That's our show for the day.
I'm talking more about policing black men's behavior because I don't have their life or their experience.
You know, it's these kind of movements, these kind of actions, and I certainly wouldn't want to conflate Colin Kaepernick with Muhammad Ali, because I've seen that and I think that's stupid, like just as a factual matter, you know, with all due respect to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and anybody else who's made that comparison. But oftentimes, historically, so whether you're talking about Carlos Rogers, the 68 Olympics, the black raised fist, whether you're talking about Muhammad Ali, whether you're talking about in different contexts, LeBron James recently. Taking these courageous stands, irrespective of their qualifications to, you know, to espouse or speak on political actions, it has been a catalyst in history for larger political actions. And so, what, you know, Colin Kaepernick absolutely has a right, and I think that he's exercising that right. And I question his intentions. That's a different conversation. But I think he absolutely has a right to be a catalyst if he wishes to put himself in harm's way to start this conversation, you know, or Michael Sam a couple years ago during the NFL draft choosing to kiss his partner during the NFL draft, or Jason Collins, you know, God bless them for having the courage and the willingness to put themselves in harm's way. And I don't mind them having that pressure so long as they're willing to take on that pressure and absorb it for the benefit of conversation. Because ultimately, that's the benefit, is the conversation.
Jossie Ross is in conversation with you and Pamela Banks and Erica C. Barnett. And we're going to pick up again with the news of the week. We'll talk about an island for homeless people and treating the left lane as your personal island and more on the Week in Review. Stay tuned. This is KUOW's Week in Review, still talking with you. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. By the way, that was Jossie Ross conversating there, and you can meet Jossie in person because, Jossie, you're one of our speakers at KUOW's. We're having a Region of Boom event. That's our series about Region of Boom, talking about the Seahawks, our growing pains around here. We have a series about it called Region of Boom, and this event at Town Hall is coming up September 15th. And we're tweeting out a link to the event details. Thanks for joining us on that, Josh.
Yeah, thanks for. Is it going to be free food?
You know,
I did it under the assumption. I agreed under the assumption that there would be free food there. Well, so if there's not, we might have to reconsider this.
Bill, I know Jossie personally. He has to eat.
Yes?
Yeah, that's how it. How do you keep that energy going?
Oh, yeah,
you
right.
Know?
Turn into Joe Pesci. I'm one of those Snickers commercials.
Well, then we're going to make that happen for you. So I hope you can join us at Town Hall. Continuing with the news now. This week, The Stranger rescinded its endorsement of a candidate for Washington State Superintendent of Public Instruction. The candidate is named Erin Jones. She's a former assistant state superintendent, an award-winning educator. The group Equal Rights Washington opposes her, saying Jones has shown insensitivity to LGBTQ students. Among other things, Jones questioned the new state teaching standards when it comes to gender, saying that it's not developmentally appropriate to talk about gender or sexual orientation with five-year-olds. And we can get into more of this, but Pamela Banks, why do you support Erin Jones for Superintendent of Public Instruction?
I support Erin because I know her personally and her record. I look at her educational background and her commitment to education publicly. And, you know, have we in this state, given we have a lot of kids of color in the school district, Erin speaks five languages. She's been a teacher. She's been an administrator. I think she wrote an open letter that The Stranger produced, and it goes to the core of who she is. You know, I don't know where she made those statements, if she made those statements, but I found when I was running for office that people tend to say things that you said and there's no collaboration, or they said it three times and then it was true. And again, I'm not defending. I think that she, in her letter, she was very pointed and said, I'm learning. This is not my lane. My lane is over here. And so I think given where we're going, and that she, you know, like we all make mistakes. No one is perfect. But I know her, like I said, personally. I'm not in the position where I can endorse people because of my role at the Urban League. But I think if she made an error, she's apologized for that error. She's made it very clear. She's open. She wants to learn. And I I was really shocked to hear it. I was really out of state when all this broke down, and so I just learned of this like within the last 48 hours.
Erica?
Well, I would say that it is her lane because she's she was running to be the head of schools in the state. And one of the things that you have to be aware of in public schools is that there are trans students and there are lesbian and gay students and all different gender identities. And in her open letter and also in her responses on Facebook, I didn't see in particular any response to any of the questions that the stranger or people on Facebook raised about transgender students. And she may feel that it's developmentally inappropriate up until fourth grade, which is what she said in a written statement that is available online, so it is corroborated, to the Southwest Washington Conservative blog. She said that she didn't believe that transgenderism should be taught until
I think the blogger used the word transgenderism,
she got
criticized for not calling them out on that. I don't think she used the word transgenderism.
Correct, but her opponent did challenge that and said that this is a right-wing trope, and it was a recognizable one. And I guess I fundamentally feel that you can't be learning on the job when you're dealing with children. There are children who identify as transgender much younger than fourth grade, and children are aware of gender differences as young as 2 or 3 years old. And so you can't just pretend that that doesn't matter until a certain point when you decide it's developmentally appropriate to talk about it.
Why can't you be learning on the job? I mean, she's not a school counselor with that young child. She's in Olympia running a bureaucracy. Why can't she learn on the job if she needs to learn?
Well, the bureaucracy sets standards for the schools, and if she's opposed to standards that acknowledge gender identity and that say, for example, we've had all these wars about bathrooms in our state. If something comes up in the legislature, for example, where there's a dispute or a debate over access to the bathroom that corresponds to your gender identity, then that's going to be something she's going to have to be ready to weigh in on. And I felt that, you know, I read her letter too very closely, and I read all of her responses to people on Facebook because she was in there responding to some things. She did not respond to anything about transgender children, and she also conflated gay, in her word, and transgender individuals in a way that I thought showed kind of a fundamental lack of understanding. And I didn't feel that she answered the questions that I still have.
I do want to go to Jossie too, but Pamela, since you feel differently about this, you know, Erin Jones didn't answer the stranger says she didn't answer directly when asked whether being gay is a sin. She reportedly talked about LGBTQ identity as a lifestyle, and she does seem to feel that the new state teaching standards are inappropriate. Why doesn't this reach the level of a substantive problem for you who know Erin personally and feel she sincerely maybe regrets some of her words?
Again, I think that she is in the position of, and you do learn, and Erica, I have to disagree with you. I'm gonna compare it to like culturally competency when you're teaching kids of color. So we have a school district right now in the Seattle area, 50%+ kids of color. You speak 100 different languages. The majority of the teachers are white. We have over time developed that these teachers are coming in and they're suspending black and brown children at a higher rate, right? So this is a learning thing. So it's not coming in and saying that these teachers have implicit bias, that we have black and brown boys that are, you know, overactive, they're putting them in special ed. So so that's why I say it is a learning thing on the job, because we've been historically doing this to our kids, and this is new. This is not her lane. And even for me, when I ran for office and I was...
new, meaning transgender and LGBTQ issues?
Publicly, right. I mean, our state, our city, they're not talking about this in, you know, I just came back from Baltimore, but that's not in their agenda. So we're unique in that way because we are progressive and we are liberal.
But it was a huge issue in Olympia last year. I was just reading about it being a huge issue in Iowa. This you know, sort of terrorizing people for using bathrooms
again, as a superintendent, Erin's not going to terrorize children. I mean, that's not what it's about. For me, it's about you have to allow people when this is not our lane. I didn't know a lot about the LGBT community and when I was running for office. And as I was getting interviewed in different arenas, and I happened to have a campaign manager that educated me about what was going on, even the discrimination that they faced being people of color in that community. So you can't, I don't think you can say that this is not an opportunity for people to learn and change, because we do that in our daily lives. Nobody is perfect on this issue. This is a tough topic that I think that she is trying to address, and I don't think she's trying to be, you know, surveillance, or that she'd come in and say, no, we don't need transgender bathrooms, or no, we can't do this. So I think we should actually have a conversation with her. And again, I haven't even had a chance to talk to her. Like I said, I just learned of this less than 48 hours ago, and I didn't reach out to her, but that's why I feel the way I feel about it.
Just really quickly, I'm not saying that Erin Jones wants to terrorize children. I'm saying that she should be prepared to combat and have an answer to people who are in Olympia and elsewhere.
Jossie.
Yeah, I think it's a dangerous precedent when we, I've been in situations where I certainly could have been stronger regarding defense or speaking up about gender inequality, sensitivity to LGBTQ community. I probably said stuff when I was a kid. I think we have to allow people to evolve. I think I'm a different person than I was then. And so if a person has in fact had those incidents, which I think all of us had in different contexts, when we have that thing called privilege and we all exercise different types of privilege, and we don't utilize that space in order to bring somebody else with us that is part of a group that is being, their voices being oppressed or silenced. We all have those moments, and we have to give people an opportunity to, okay, do you still feel like this? To evolve.
But she said it in June.
Excuse me, hold on. To evolve. And to say that we actually, you know, we encourage people to be better than they were previously, to grow up. And so, you know, I know there was a question from Stranger reporter Sydney Brownstone, which is a great story. And she talked about that she sort of changed her story. Well, that's a different substantive question than saying, did you believe like this at one time, or did you say this at one time? To say that in fact, I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond, to say how you feel now, and to show us your work. And that body of work is ultimately going to be dispositive and important toward our endorsement, because that's ultimately what we're talking about here, right? Is endorsement and ultimately voting for this particular candidate.
I don't think you evolve that much between June and August. I just don't. I mean, it's not like she said these things as a child. And it's also, she did have an opportunity to respond, and she didn't address a lot of the specific things that Sydney brought up in her story.
I don't know. I can't put a time scale on evolution. I can't say when somebody, maybe they've had that opportunity. I've had changes within the past few years where I've substantially changed my views. And so I think putting these artificial caps, arbitrary, you know, timing sort of ceilings on when somebody is supposed to evolve and get the truth, get this epiphany, I think that's kind of disingenuous and very assumptive.
Okay, well, we'll pause there, and the voters will get to decide how long and how much people can evolve, because this is going to be on your fall ballot. We've been talking about the contest for Washington State Superintendent of Public Instruction. You can see the Stranger's reporting on it, of course, online, and find out more about it yourself. We're talking with the president of the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle, Pamela Banks, an attorney, writer, activist, Jossie Ross. Erica Barnett writes for The C is for Crank.com, and we're coming back with Camping Out. So stay tuned. KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. This week, the vice chair of the King County Democrats publicly entertained the idea of giving homeless people their own island. Omaha Sternberg saw the idea on Twitter and responded, well, there might be something to this. She told Cairo Radio that since the city of Seattle's constantly taking down unauthorized tent camps, an island where homeless people voluntarily go and govern themselves could be an improvement.
It provides some kind of consistency for them. That there has to be transportation from the island to Seattle on a regular basis. So the concept that comes to my mind is something like a water taxi that happens on a regular basis, like every hour, every half hour. And then they would be able to, on a regular basis, come from the island to Seattle to do work, to try to get work. And when they come back, then they would be able to make decisions about what is happening on the island itself, how things are going to occur.
The King County Democratic Party says Sternberg does not speak for the organization. Quote, the notion of setting aside an island somewhere where our region's homeless population can create a self-governing community is an inappropriate fantasy that does not merit serious consideration. Erica, Sternberg says she's being unfairly accused of supporting some Hunger Games-type government internment camp when actually she's talking about something voluntary. Was she out of line?
I mean, it's useful as a metaphor. I don't think that anybody would necessarily take that seriously. Maybe she was being serious. I don't know. But I think it's really telling both about people's attitude toward. I think it's telling about people's attitude toward the homeless and about the lack of understanding of what homelessness really is. So the idea of this island is that there would be services. Okay, well, one of the main things that homeless people need is housing. So what are you going to do? Build housing on the island? Okay.
So well, she did go on and say that there are construction sites sure. where there's leftover wood and brick and they would donate to a nonprofit.
Yeah. I mean, this is all patently absurd, right? But I think that then, you know, then homeless people also, in many cases, need jobs. Those are not going to be on an island. And I think just kind of creating this. And the main
and
thing.
And she did say that they would then go and look yeah. for work in Seattle after they come there on the water
sure.
taxi.
And the main, maybe we can have jitneys, whatever. The main thing, it though, is that all people, I think, need is community. And I think when you have this concept that homeless people are all a certain type of person that is fundamentally different than people who are housed, that's where the idea of community goes away, and you just think those people don't need community like I do. And what you're doing is dehumanizing them, obviously, by saying they can just be put in a concentration camp somewhere. And you're also
I just want to separate. I'm not disagreeing with everything you're saying, but uh-huh. just to separate things out, she says that it's that kind of calling this a concentration camp. Omaha Sternberger saying that's the unfair knee-jerk part when I'm talking about something voluntary. And she's talking about a kind of community, but a community of self-governing homeless people, not zero community.
Well, I think that people have the right to create their own community. And I don't think primarily the thing that people have in common with each other is their housing situation. So I have friends who own homes. I have friends who rent. I have friends who are rich. I have friends who are poor. I'm not friends with people just because of their housing situation. And I think that, you know, I think when people say services, they say we can just put all the services there and they need to, because I know another thing she said was that the services need to be concentrated in one place and they need to be centralized. I think when people say services, they mean drug and addiction treatment and they mean mental health treatment. And that is important. To the percentage of the population that has those problems. That is not everybody. The main common problem that homeless people have is that they don't have a home. And the other thing is, just going back to community, I don't think services should be centralized in one area. I think that they should be in the communities that people are in, because the reality is that unless we dehumanize homeless people, we have to acknowledge that they live in communities too, and they live all over our city, and they do that for reasons. And if we don't ask them what the reasons are, then we get to absurd ideas like this island where they could just all go and get, you know, quote unquote, the help they need.
Anybody else? We have two nodding people.
Yeah, I agree generally with what Erica said. I'm not convinced that she's serious. But then again, I'm not convinced that Donald Trump still is running for president. there's certain things that sound so patently absurd that, nah, this can't be real. And then you realize, no, these people are serious. So if you discuss the merits of it, Erica definitely broke it down incredibly well regarding services is kind of one of those terms, especially when talking about homeless folks. It's sort of like saying urban. Well, we know what urban means, right? It means black. And services, when you're talking about homeless people, we're talking exactly just about mental health services. We're talking about needle exchange, stuff like that. But there's a whole bunch of other services that, quote unquote, normal people who have homes, who are properly housed, have. You know, they need those other services. And so what about those vacuums in there? You're talking about a pretty significant infrastructural problem right there in order to be able to create a livable situation for anybody. Not just somebody who needs those additional services.
Pamela, I'm hearing two of our guests say that this discussion of homeless island is more useful as a metaphor. It's more useful as fiction. And fiction is not false. Fiction can shine a truth that maybe is how we actually a lot of people actually think of homelessness. But what's your take on this situation?
I'm going to agree with most what Erica said. I think it shows a lack of understanding about why people are homeless or housing unstable. And the issue is we don't have enough affordable housing in our city. And so putting people on an island isn't going to solve that. And I think that people generally have a lack of understanding of what's going on in our city right now around homeless. Yeah, there is a lot of people that are drug and alcohol addicted, and they need services to address that. But I think they need their housing first. I truly believe, and when I worked with in city government, and we had a policy around homelessness and encampments and a 10-year plan to end it. And we got waylaid when mayors leave and administrations change. And I think the thing is we have a true lack of affordable housing. We have a true lack of enough people on the same page to try and address it, because we put a lot of money into services and it is not stopping the homeless issue. So it's more, it's just, so it's not just this blanket, oh, let's put them on an island. It's really about how do we look within, how do we partner private sector, public sector, nonprofits, churches, and community to solve this issue together.
I think it works really well as a metaphor also for the sweeps that we're doing and sort of the, if you take that to its logical extreme, right now what the city does is it moves people from one place to another and confiscates their possessions. And the solution that the city has found and the solution that the mayor is committed to in one form or another is to continue doing that without the adequate services and housing available for people to actually not live in encampments anymore. And so it's kind of the ultimate metaphor. And that's why I do think, even if it is quote unquote voluntary, first of all, let's say this happened, it's not going to happen. And I don't think it's a serious proposal. But if we had a quote unquote voluntary island, the pressure, I mean, can you imagine, like, homeless people are already harassed to an extreme degree now just for taking up space and being visible. When you have an island where they can go, I can't even imagine what it would be like to be one of the remaining homeless people. And that's why I think it is the idea is an internment camp. And it's basically saying, we really, really, really don't want you in any of our backyards. We don't want to see you. And so I think that's what people are saying now. And this is just like the logical metaphor for what that would look like if you actually made it so that people didn't have to see them.
This is why Homeless Island is sort of a useful fiction, that it tells a truth that we might otherwise miss, because in all the bureaucracy and all the arguing, the truth that we already, even many liberals, treat homeless people as being on their own island. We pay lip service to giving them all homes, and we don't do it, haven't done it. We want to believe there's a way that they can be independent and safe and not bother us. And we don't have to admit that maybe we don't like how they look, and we don't have to know that sometimes they commit crimes, and let's deal with that. And so I think Homeless Island should be a novel about our hopes and fears and guilt.
I sort of want to write it now.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Okay, listeners, go write that short story.
Dystopian kind of science fiction.
Kind of. Not science fiction enough.
Not enough.
Because we got two writers here.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Facebook, our Facebook page, KUOW there, and on Twitter, we are tweeting at KUOW. That's a 144-foot short story that you can write us. And the Week in Review continues in just a moment. If you're a slow writer, fine. If you're a slow driver, problem. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review, talking with Jossie and Pamela and Erica and you. And if you've driven outside of the Seattle area, you know that lots of Seattle drivers hang out in the left lane without passing, while people who would like to pass are stuck behind them. This is illegal in Washington, even if you're going the speed limit. It's illegal. Our state patrol has issued tickets to left lane campers, and that might upset these drivers. But this week on NPR's All Things Considered, freelance science reporter Joseph Stromberg produced evidence that hanging out in the left lane is dangerous.
The moments at which you're most at risk of getting into a crash is when you're changing lanes. And when you have people going slow in the left lane as well as the right lane, then people who want to move faster kind of have to zigzag back and forth. They have to change lanes, looking over both different shoulders, and it just increases the amount of possible accident scenarios that can happen.
Every state has laws that discourage left lane driving, and some, including Ohio, Texas, and Washington, are handing out tickets.
But wait a minute, you might be saying to yourself, I'm going the speed limit. I can't be the problem. Oh, yes, you can. Here's Stromberg again.
One of the best predictors of an accident isn't necessarily whether someone's speeding or not, but the difference between the average speed of traffic surrounding them and how fast they're going. And it turns out that going 5 miles per hour slower than the surrounding speed of traffic puts you at a greater risk of accident than going 5 miles per hour faster.
And slower drivers can mean more traffic jams.
There is, you know, strong research showing that just a small amount of congestion can ripple outwards and make a really big traffic jam. And a lot of times that's because of just a few cars that are going slower than the speed limit or just at it and blocking up both lanes. And that causes, you know, layers and layers of people trying to pass just back up behind them. And so it's annoying, but it also really can cause legitimate congestion.
So if you're driving this Labor Day weekend, let the lead foots have the left lane.
You'll be doing everyone a favor. But this
long line of cars. On KOW's Facebook page, a commenter said, left lane camping is a cultural thing, like parking facing the wrong way. Do you think left lane camping is a cultural thing here, and why would that be?
Definitely.
Why?
Well, I don't have a theory as to why, except, you know, y'all all crazy. Uh-huh. I came here from Texas, and it's interesting that they're ticketing people there, but I learned to drive in Houston, and we have a very different culture there. It's very aggressive. I think here, you know, I moved here, I came over the border, and all of a sudden it was like no one knew how to drive. You know, maybe it's because it's foggy all the time.
Maybe we're not in a hurry enough for you.
Ooh.
Oh, well, I think people are just inattentive about driving here. And I think it's interesting that behavior is actually what impacts congestion. So next time somebody's complaining about roads not being wide enough, I'm going to say, actually, it's your fault.
We have a minute and a half left. Jossie and Pamela.
I just want to say it's lack of education. It is really annoying. I really do. I think people just think if I'm going the speed limit, and I think people don't. I on a whole, I want to say I don't think they understand that that is against the law.
I think it's attributed to the passive aggressiveness of Seattleites and Pacific Northwesterners generally. They moved here for a reason, to get away from as many people as possible. And one of the stories I like to tell in regards to that, to make it tangible, to make it real, is when I'm in line someplace, sometimes people would do these crazy Gumby contortions to try to squeeze between me and the next person in line instead of simply saying, excuse me. That's an educational thing to honk. No, move out of the way. Just excuse me.
People are here for the mountains and the water and the woods, and we don't care for people. So the hell with the human being who's stuck behind me. I care about what the sign says, and the sign says the limit is 60, and that's what I'm doing, and I'm sticking to it.
How's is that what you're doing,
culture?
Bill?
I'm capturing local culture. So now you know, Texan. Now you know, Texan. We're wrapping up now from the Week in Review with Pamela Banks, president of the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle, local attorney, writer, Jossie Ross, Erica Barnett, thecisforcrank.com. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
You'll have a great weekend.
Speed up in that left lane, or just get over, okay?
Pull people over, please.